journal, the Marxist Left Review, but is also the author of a book on the Australian Labor Party and Labor's conflict, which you can get in our bookshop. So make Tom welcome.
Thank you, comrades. Well, look, when we look at British politics today, you have to say that the political situation in Westminster is in the deepest crisis it has been for many, many decades. This is a profound crisis enveloping the British establishment, with its preferred party, the Conservative Party, which has been in government for the big majority of modern British politics, now tearing itself apart. The Brexit referendum called by David Cameron for 2016 to crush the Eurosceptics in the Tory ranks completely backfired on the party, the result costing not just Cameron his position, but most likely also Theresa May. The Tories are trying to push through Brexit in the face of opposition from the overwhelming majority of the big bourgeoisie and all the major organs of the British state apparatus, defending which has been the main purpose of the Conservative Party for its entire existence. As with many other countries now, the party favoured by the ruling class in Britain has become partially unmoored from that class in the context of a more general crisis of governance throughout the Western liberal democracies. In a historic irony, the capitalist class in Britain is now finding itself in a situation long faced by the working class, in that this party is not fighting for its class interests. And that really, in some ways, very much encapsulates the crisis that the Tories are in. It's not just that it can't get any one of its numerous different Brexit options up through Westminster. It's that there is a sea change that is now taking place, which constitutes consists of unmooring of the traditional party of the British establishment from its major class bases. Now, the Brexit referendum was not the only misjudgment by the Tories in recent years. The other was the general election called by Theresa May in April 2017. Now, if you look back at the papers at the time, generally her decision to call that election was regarded as a masterstroke. The Labour Party was languishing at 25%, the Tories were 47%. It was going to be a walk in the park for the Conservatives. But, of course, as we know, things did not turn out that way. The election backfired badly on the Conservatives, with Labour enjoying the biggest swing towards it since 1945, and the Conservatives forced to rely on the floor of Parliament, on the Democratic Unionist Party, which has nothing to do with unions and is certainly not democratic. It's a party of the Orange Order in the north of Ireland. And that DUP is one of the many factors, actually, that is limiting Theresa May's freedom to manoeuvre in Westminster today around Brexit. So the Tories, as is obvious, front page after front page in the newspapers, tearing at each other and tearing each other apart. They're now trailing badly in the polls. The last few polls come through in the last 6 weeks or so. And faced with the threat of big setbacks at the two elections that may take place next month. I say may take place because if Britain crashes out of the European Union before, well, the next probably 2 or 3 weeks, it won't be participating in the Euro elections. But if it seems likely, it will be. Actually, the number one party in the polling in the Euro elections is Nigel Farage's new creation, the Brexit Party, with the Tories, in fact, running third. They also face big setbacks in the elections, which definitely will be happening next month, which is the local government elections. And bad results for the Tories in this party will only exacerbate the tensions within the Conservatives. But Labour too faces problems, even if they're not existential ones like the Tories. Essentially, the problem the Labour Party faces is that its leader has little support amongst his parliamentary caucus. But the vast majority of trade union members, and for the time being, many of the leading trade union leaders, are actually in favour of Corbyn's leadership. Corbyn has decisively won two leadership ballots, and at the 2017 general election, defying all the gloomy predictions, won a big swing towards the Labour Party. In the summer of 2017, you only have to think back at Corbyn at Glastonbury, with people singing his name. Corbyn was the man of the hour, in touch with the popular mood, whereas the Conservatives got a bloody nose. But despite Corbyn's success, at that election, which confirmed him in the leadership, this has not stopped his opponents from attacking him day after day, week after week. This opposition has come most obviously in the media, with not just the Tory rags like The Sun and The Express and The Mail and The Telegraph attacking Corbyn, but more seriously from the point of view of the Labour Party, also The Guardian newspaper and also the BBC. So they've been running headlines against Corbyn essentially ever since he first put his hat in the ring for the leadership of the party. Now, this all ramped up last year as the Territory moved to a systemic campaign. In fact, it actually goes back beyond that. It goes back to about 2016, 2017, of the alleged anti-Semitism that is supposedly rife within the Labour Party and to which Jeremy Corbyn supposedly is turning a blind eye. So last year, the argument centred on whether or not the Labour Party was going to adopt a particular definition of anti-Semitism that essentially glued together anti-Semitism and attacks on Israel. And Jeremy Corbyn, as a long-standing supporter of Palestine, was obviously not going to accept that that manoeuvre sitting down. But in the end, Corbyn was isolated in the question because on the national executive, the big trade union leaders who've been backing Corbyn in the last few years essentially backed the change in definition of anti-Semitism to include any attacks on Israel. Simply saying Israel is a racist project is enough to deem you essentially an anti-Semite in British politics today. And the right have been using this stick to mercilessly and remorselessly beat the left inside the party and any, in particular, any of Corbyn supporters. This has been used, needless to say, entirely hypocritically, entirely instrumentally, and entirely unseriously, and in fact, actually dangerously, because by attempting to allege that Jeremy Corbyn, a man who stood against racism all his life, is a major anti-Semitic threat in British politics, is to in fact let the real anti-Semites off the hook. Actually, because by pointing to the left as being the source of anti-Semitism, all the far-right bigots that attack both Jews and particularly Muslims are left without any pressure on them. And so anti-Semitism is being used in the same way as we've seen elements of in the United States for attacks on Ilhan Omar, one of the Democrats emerging there. But it's not just anti-Semitism. Corbyn has faced a campaign to obviously, first of all, unseat him since he was elected. Once that so dismally failed from the point of view of his right-wing opponents, a constant campaign of leaking, backgrounding, lies, gossip to undermine Corbyn and to provide the press ever ready to seize any opportunity to attack Corbyn with more material for their headlines. But this isn't just obviously the question of the press. It's also, and not just even actually the most right-wing Blairites. We see Corbyn's own deputy, Tom Watson, openly calling big meetings of 150 MPs and Lords in Westminster with the open project of undermining his own leader. Now, normally in the course of things, you'd assume the deputy should be loyal to his leader or her leader, not so in the British Labour Party today. It's fair game, essentially. It's basically say, we're proposing to cross the floor, we're proposing to form a bloc with Liberal Tories, anything goes if it serves the objective of attacking and undermining the Corbyn leadership. Now, these attacks are made more seriously, not just because they come from, Tony Blair's friends and the Mandelsons of the world and so forth, not just because they come from the likes of Gordon Brown supporters, but also because they are echoed and given real weight by the undermining by many of the trade union leaders, and particularly the left-wing trade union leaders who are heads of the big unions like Unison and Unite and the GMBU. So the relationship between Corbyn and the leaders of British unions is worth understanding because it's an unusual situation whereby the big union leaders will be backing the left wing of the party. The whole history of the British Labour Party is that the big unions essentially form a praetorian guard around the right-wing parliamentary leadership in order to fend off any attacks from left-wing electorate, constituency Labour Party, as they're called in Britain, the local branches. And in the case of Corbyn, what we find, in fact, is that the trade union leaders have not so much formed the praetorian guard, but at least a stable voting bloc for Corbyn in internal election campaigns. Now, why is this? Primarily because they were driven to the margins by both Blair and Brown when they were leaders. They were marginalised for major decision making as those leaders tried to push the Labour Party to the right, and who pushed trade union legislation more and more in an anti-working class direction. So these leaders saw Corbyn as someone who could bring them back into the fold and who might pass legislation that would make their job of organising British workers more straightforward and somewhat less onerous than it is today, thanks to generations of attacks by Tory and Labour governments. So that's why they stood behind Corbyn. But of course, they're trade union leaders. They're not people who frolic around with ideas of systemic political change in Britain. They're people who see their political role as an extension of their industrial role, which is one of compromise, which is one of conciliation, one of bringing the classes together, while advancing the cause of the workers while you do that. They do not want to see a hard left-wing Labour government. They want partnership with business, not expropriation. And so while they've been standing in Corbyn's corner in the internal leadership contest, they've been trying to squeeze him and extract concessions out of him so that an incoming Corbyn Labour government, or indeed even a Corbyn opposition, were not scared of horses in big business. So the vote on anti-Semitism, when they basically shoved British Labour Party policy to the right to essentially adopt the arguments of the Zionists, was just one example of that. The vote on the Trident nuclear program at the 2016 National Conference, when, against the wishes of Corbyn, a long-standing anti-nuclear campaigner, the trade union leaders threw their bloc votes behind renewing and updating the Trident nuclear program. And also at last year's conference, the trade union leaders threw their lot in to prevent automatic deselection of MPs. The left in the party has been pushing for deselection in order to essentially get rid of the hundreds of, or 150 or thereabouts, of people who basically want to bring down Corbyn and replace them with left-wing people who are much more in tune with the mood of Labour Party members. The trade union leaders prevented this from happening, ensuring that Corbyn's continued dependence on them. Because if Corbyn was able to rely on a parliamentary caucus full of his supporters, he'd be less dependent on the trade union leaders to back him up. And therefore, this gives them leverage over the Labour parliamentary leadership. Now, this is especially true, the dependence of Corbyn on the trade union leaders and his relatively fragile position is especially the case because the trade union leaders have done nothing to build popular struggle outside Parliament. The strike rate remains at all-time lows. The level of trade union organising remains at all-time lows. The level of social struggle of all kinds remains at all-time lows. And so the result then is the kind of mobilisation that could lift Corbyn and lift the Labour Party, the left of the Labour Party, is actually absent, making the focus much more on parliamentary manoeuvres rather than open class struggle, which is something that always weakened the position of the left. Another factor in all this, of course, is Corbyn's own politics. That Corbyn is a genuine social democrat, a man who basically stood on some social democratic principles his whole life, who saw his career marginalised by the Blair and Brown administrations for precisely that reason, who was regarded as being, you know, far out leftist for decades, but nonetheless it's important to understand the limits of Corbyn's own politics as well. The 2017 general election manifesto, for example, was not as left-wing as the election manifesto of 1974, 1945, 1964 either. It was only left-wing in the sense it appeared so different to the manifestos of the Blair and Brown administration leaderships. That so far to the right has British politics gone, so far to the right has social democracy gone internationally, that a fairly mild programme of economic and social and political reform that Labour put up in 2017 is now seen as being a real fighting manifesto. So obviously, there was a big wave of enthusiasm behind Corbyn in 2017, but you have to understand also the limits of it. As a social democrat, Corbyn has got no conception of going beyond leadership of a parliamentary party which wants to take state power and run the country in the interests of workers. The rhetoric is all about opening the doors of the state to more democratic participation and broader representation. The problem is, though, this is essentially a problem of liberal democracy or social democracy. The problem with this, then, is that it limits the ambitions of the Corbyn leadership. Because his project essentially is to run the British state machine, to reform it, mind you, but to run essentially the British state machine with its huge apparatus of the military and the bureaucracy and the heads of the public service and the whole apparatus, and not to rip it down, that also makes him partly a puppet of that machine as well. And as far as he sees his project as one of renovating British capitalism, this also puts Corbyn under pressure when it's put to him that programmes of raising taxes on business, expanding social spending and so forth will undermine the interests of British industry. If your project is to try to advance Britain's position in the world, even as a kind of caring, sharing kind of progressive country, it also leaves you open to the argument that if you get rid of Trident, then Britain's defences will be laid open. And so the problem then is that a social democratic project of a moderate kind, as Corbyn's is not capable of really breaking with the establishment, and therefore leaves him open to attacks from that very same establishment. As someone who sees Parliament as sovereign, with mass movements only playing an auxiliary role, his natural orientation is not to building struggles outside Parliament. Although he has a great record himself of participating in them, they are not the priority for his leadership. And as someone who believes fervently in the Labour Party, no matter how much his leadership has mistreated him and condemned and maligned him for decades, he's not willing to use his popular base amongst the party to seriously challenge the union bureaucracy who form a core element of the party machinery. Now, can I just check something? I feel I'm getting some kind of feedback going on here. Yes? Turn the microphone down a bit. Just bear with me a second here. I just see if I can go down here. Come on. How's that? Is that any better? We'll see how we go. All right, thumbs up, thumbs down. A bit better. It doesn't sound like quite howling so much. Okay, now I've got your attention again. All right. So, this talk is actually meant to be about Brexit. So let's start talking about Brexit, shall we? Okay, Brexit, needless to say, is hurting the Labour Party. Corbyn's attitude, quite sensibly in many respects, has been to try to bury Brexit for as long as possible. He campaigned weekly, despite himself having been a long advocate of Brexit, he campaigned weekly for Remain during the referendum, but refused to appear on platforms with the bosses, or the Tories, or Liberal Democrats, as he was urged to do so. During the 2017 general election campaign, he virtually ignored Brexit. And during 2018, he and his Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell essentially adopted what's called a stance of studied ambiguity, hoping to essentially to force the Tories to collapse while Labour could watch on isolated from the damage. Now, there's an obvious reason for Corbyn to do this, because enthusiastic endorsement of either Remain or Leave would involve opening up the wide divisions within the party. Backing Remain or a soft version of Brexit would annoy the one-third of Labour voters who voted for Leave in 2016. But backing Leave or potentially a hard Brexit would antagonise the majority of the parliamentary Labour Party, the trade union leaders, and more particularly the bulk of the membership who I would think probably overwhelmingly support Remain. And so Corbyn is in a tricky position within the party. And so he has not sought to advance any clear position on Brexit. Labour's position is for a customs union, access to EU markets, some protection for workers' rights, but also an end to free movement. But beyond that, nothing. Neither backing Remain nor making a clear left-wing case for leaving. The strategy has simply been to hope the Tories implode, ushering in a general election. Now, that is, you could say, in 2017 and 2018 was quite a sensible strategy. But 2019, and the whole question of Brexit dominating British politics, simply standing back is not sufficient to galvanise your support. In fact, it's rather allowing other actors to occupy the field while you avoid taking a clear stance. The basic problem is that none of the forces supporting Brexit openly or more covertly want to fight for a genuinely left-wing Brexit that might involve combining free movement of people with defending workers' rights and advancing a programme for broadening of public services. So you see, when you look at people like Len McCluskey, the leader of Unite, or Corbyn's director of strategy, Seamus Milne, they basically have a fairly unreconstructed nationalist project involving building up British industry and British jobs for British workers. They take up all the right-wing arguments about Brexit being an opportunity to restore national sovereignty, only therefore echoing the likes of Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Tory Brexiteer. The problem is, in terms of what counts for the left inside the British Labour Party, at least around Corbyn's circles, opposition to free movement is taken for granted. So some around Corbyn are in principle for a racist take in Brexit. That is, basically shut down the British, shut down the British borders and keep foreign workers out. Others simply work on the assumption that Labour voters themselves are hostile to migrants and a supporting free movement would see them decimated at the next election. Or that the only way to deal with racist views is to capitulate to them. For them, winning votes is more important than stopping attacks on immigrants. So ending free movement, even though incorporated into party platform 2 years ago, has now come to the fore as one of Labour's major red lines in dealing with any and voting for any Brexit deal. The result, however, is the party isn't capable of championing anti-racism and undercutting the right. The hundreds of thousands that joined the party in 2015, seeing in Corbyn a progressive voice for them, seeing in the Labour Party potentially a vehicle for fighting racism, are left stranded. With the left not willing to defend free movement, it is the right who support Remain on a neoliberal basis, who appear to be the champion of anti-racism, because they're the people saying we need to defend free movement, the rights of European workers in Britain, even if they're also opposed, of course, equally opposed to migration from outside the European Union. They're okay with immigration controls so long as the immigration controls involve drowning Africans in the Mediterranean. The wrong colour. Okay, and then there's a question of the second referendum. Again, the party is split down the middle on this. The leadership in Corbyn and the politicians representing Leave electorates are all opposed to it, as in fact is a big majority of the Tory party, albeit for and with widely differing reasons. The majority of members, however, many of the Labour parliamentarians and Remain electorates, along with many Remain supporting union leaders, support a second referendum. As, of course, does the ruling class and its main mouthpieces, which see in it an opportunity to dump Brexit once and for all. Now, unlike the question of free movement, you can't say there's a question of principle when it comes to a second referendum. But the outcome has been the same. The longer the Brexit drags on, the more it pushes British society to the right. Insofar as the Labour leaders oppose the second referendum, they find themselves in bed with the majority of the Tory party who are also opposed to one, because they want to get out and now. Insofar as they begin to give ground to it, they help to legitimise the neoliberal Remainers and take the oxygen away from the demand, which has been Corbyn's position, for a fresh general election. Now, I just want to say a few words about momentum. Some of you may know of momentum. I'm not quite sure how best to classify it. Dave Renton might have an explanation, maybe a lobby group perhaps within the Labour Party, a pressure group. It's not a formal faction. Momentum was formed essentially to help push left-wing causes within the party and to get behind Corbyn. Momentum has been very active in pushing for change within the party, and it's well supported. 40,000 members at last count, and at the National Conference last year got 80 of its members up on the National Executive. So it's a force of some power, of some influence. But it has done nothing to mobilise Labour Party members for action outside simply parliamentary ballots. Momentum is run by a small cabal and is completely undemocratic. It's therefore deaf to demands amongst some of its members for more fighting and active stance outside Parliament. And is politically all over the place on questions of principle. Its lead figure, you might even say its owner, its manager, its chief executive, John Landsman, joined in the hue and cry demanding Corbyn capitulate on the question of supposed anti-Semitism within the party. But the problem is not just with the trade union leaders, not just with the strategies of momentum. The problem is that the passivity that's so obvious is not fundamentally out of kilter with the passivity of the membership of the Labour Party more generally. Overwhelmingly, the hundreds of thousands have joined the Labour Party since Corbyn won in 2015, have done so in the hope of getting Labour up at the next general election, hoping that will usher in a genuinely reformist government, even indeed a socialist government. The big majority of new recruits are politically raw, fairly young people for the most part, who have no conception or experience in building a fighting left. Their inexperience and lack the theoretical wherewithal to push back against, for example, the anti-Semitic slurs against Corbyn and his allies. The result, then, is that the union bureaucracy and the parliamentary caucus of Corbyn's opponents are under no pressure from the membership to wage a fighting campaign against the May government. So, the whole situation is not good for the left. The left in Britain is not in a situation of its own choosing. The entire debate around Brexit is framed by right-wing alternatives, and nothing in the current balance of forces suggests any progressive outcome of the crisis in the ranks of the May government. And the chickens have come home to roost for Corbyn. Sitting back, hoping the divisions and the Tories would destroy them, pulling back from the big street mobilisations, such as we saw in 2015 and 2016, and consistently backing down under pressure from his allies in the union bureaucracy, has rendered Corbyn passive and unable to capitalise on the situation or to crush his right-wing opponents within the party. The parliamentary focus, which is what dominates British politics today, is the best terrain for Corbyn's internal enemies to continue to white ant his leadership. And these factors then explain why it is that Theresa May, who suffered three successive parliamentary defeats on the floor of Parliament, is able to hang on, despite in other circumstances this being a clear call for her immediate departure. By any normal standards, the crisis that Theresa May is in would have seen her departure. But so far she has survived. And so she survived to the extent that the main power game is being played out in parliamentary back channels. So just to bring some threads together. The Theresa May government is caught in a trap. She cannot win a parliamentary majority for any of the approaches to Brexit, which has become a defining feature of her government. Not to leave with no deal, not to leave while remaining in the customs union, not to conduct a second referendum. Every option has been put to the floor of Parliament, everyone defeated. And as I say, Theresa May has been smashed on the floor of Parliament three times now. The extension of the withdrawal date, potentially the 31st of October, only prolongs the agony for the Conservatives. The other European Union members have no incentive to make life easy for Britain, and so it's unlikely they'll be offering Theresa May a better deal anytime soon. And as I started off by saying, if Britain does not crash out of the European Union, I'm not sure in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks or so, Britain will be obliged to participate in the Euro Parliament elections next month, and as a result of which we will likely see the Tories suffer a devastating setback at those polls as large numbers of Tory supporters decamp and go back to Nigel Farage, which is where many of them parked their votes back in 2014-2015. All the while, the British capitalist class are driven frantic by this parliamentary dead end, the crisis in the ranks of the Tory party. What's worse, also, is that from their perspective, that even when and if and however Britain does withdraw from the European Union, that's not the end of the matter. More agony awaits. Because for at least 2 years after departure, the British government, whoever's led by, will have to negotiate the terms of trade and investment with the European Union. The actual terms of trade investment, as I say, are still to be negotiated. This will be the opportunity for still more wrangling, still more roadblocks, still more dead ends, still more debacles on the floor of Parliament. You'd have to say it's not at all ruled out that Theresa May stay on top of the British Tory party, at least until Britain pulls out of the European Union, although knowing the success of my prediction, she could be out by Monday. But it's quite possible that even when Britain does leave, that there'll be a spill of leadership and Boris Johnson may take over afterwards, which is something, it should be said, that British capitalists regard as an awful prospect. In other words, in any other circumstances, the big capitalists would probably have dumped the Tory party and be looking to Labour to take over and to be mounting a campaign essentially to try to position the Labour Party as being the alternative government. But if big business hates Brexit with a passion, they hate Corbyn even more. Hence the ongoing paralysis. As for the Labour Party, civil war continues. The right Again, I hope this is a prediction I don't come to regret. The right are not going to walk away en bloc and form a new party on the lines of the SPD. Okay, whoever Change UK has given it a go, but as far as I can tell, it's not attracting more momentum. I think more likely is we're going to see more things like Tom Watson's meetings, his manoeuvring. Essentially, they know they can't defeat Corbyn on an open ballot. They tried it twice and got bloody noses both times. In fact, they got a worse result the second time round. Most likely, what they'll try to do is continue to basically white ant Corbyn, to demoralise him, to try to break away his supporters, to basically crush Corbyn leadership just by a process of kind of water torture, drip, drip, dripping, to bring down the Corbyn leadership. Essentially, they don't want to walk away from the Labour Party because they think there's Corbyn's exception. They're not the problem, Corbyn's exception. If they can get rid of Corbyn, things will be back to normal. The Labour Party will once again be in its proper place, with the right-wing parliamentarians, the more conservative union bureaucrats running the place, and restoring Labour's position as a right-wing social democratic, or even say a right-wing social neoliberal party, as it was under Blair and Brown. Now, how they expect that to happen, that Corbyn goes, we can't know. But you have to say it can't be impossible. At some stage, the left-wing union bureaucrats who've been backing Corbyn may pull the plug. And if that happens, then things begin to look a lot more dangerous for the Labour leader. It's also possible the Tories may hang on against all predictions and win the next general election, in which case you'd have to assume that Corbyn would be booted out in the aftermath of that. But it's also possible that Labour might win the next election and under Corbyn, which would obviously be a big step forward. But nothing would change in the parliamentary arithmetic. Corbyn would still face a parliamentary party stuffed full of Labour members who want him gone. They'll be egged on by the entire media and political establishment, not to mention, as we've heard, the army top brass, which will be trying to bring down a Corbyn government. Therefore, to conclude, three steps are absolutely necessary if the situation is going to be shifted onto better territory. First, no more concessions to the right by Corbyn and his allies. Two, the revitalisation of mass politics and mass mobilisation, which could help shift the focus away from Brexit towards the anti-austerity agenda that helped the left so successfully at the 2017 general election. An important element that also will be a solid anti-racist platform defending free movement of workers. To beat back the likes of Tommy Robinson and Nigel Farage, who are doing their best to generate a mass right-wing movement grounded in right-wing nationalism and immigrant bashing. The fight is not just around... the issue around Brexit is raising the hopes of the far right. The crisis in the Tory party is raising the hope of the far right. They can capitalise on this and build a hard right-wing force, both in Parliament and outside. The third element of any kind of solution is building a stronger left outside the Labour Party, both to stiffen the resolve of the left within the party to fight, but also to ensure that if and when Corbyn gives in to the right within the big business, within the party, or with the pressure from big business, or indeed he's forced out, the high hopes that were stirred up by Corbyn coming to the party leadership in 2015 are not lost to disillusionment and despair. So the project of building a genuine revolutionary left outside the Labour Party remains. That the coming to the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn has opened up opportunities, but those opportunities could equally be turned from diamonds into dust if the revolutionary left and the activist left is not able to position itself to both try to push the left and the Labour Party forward to fight racism, to fight the far right, to fight austerity, to fight the Tory government, but also to pose an alternative that does not depend on the machinations of the parliamentary system, that does not depend on the machinations of the bureaucracy, the generals, the media, or for that matter, the fact that the Labour Party ultimately is unreformable, that a new kind of party based on the workers' rights, fighting for a socialist agenda, is still necessary today.